Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with theater director Rob Ruggiero, who's here in Sarasota, Florida, to direct the Oslo Repertory Theater's first production of the 2014 season, Showboat. This is a play to which he has a particular attachment, a particular sensitivity, and he discovers some about that particular attachment in this interview. It's absolutely delightful. So hang on. Here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice, oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down you dive, where the child's gone to survive.
Is about being who you really are. Not who they told you you had to be, not who you decided it was important for you to be, not who other people are, not who your religion or your culture or your family of origin or your sister or anybody told you you needed to be or actually that you were, but who you really are. As a therapist, I see day in and day out people who made a decision early in their life to deny important pieces of themselves because that piece didn't fit with something that they were told they needed to be. And they believed, and in most cases this is true, that if they continued to demonstrate this piece of themselves, their interest in art, their sense of humor, their shyness, their assertiveness. So many of us, most of us really, make the decision to hide a piece of ourselves because demonstration of that part of ourselves will bring a consequence that we don't want. Anything from teasing up through neglect and on through to trauma for some unfortunate people. So we come out of adulthood, many of us, with a limited version of who we actually are. In my book, When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It, I call this our cover story. You know, like a spy has a cover story. And the spy knows that if the truth were known about who that person really is, there would be danger. Well, the truth is the same for us, that if we let be known aspects of ourselves that didn't fit in our cover story, there would be some danger to us. So the Lynn Show is about making this point, the point that I have already made now a number of times, that we human beings quite often hide undercover aspects of ourselves which are really important to us. And that it is possible to know this. It is possible to figure out what we have hidden. It is possible even to recover these aspects of ourselves which we have hidden. It isn't an easy process necessarily, but the first step is recognition, and that is what the Lynn Show is all about. So if you want to know more about that, about how and why we hide aspects of ourselves, how you can rediscover and maybe even recover those aspects of yourselves, you can get some of that information at my website, thelynnshow.com, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E, don't leave the E out of Lynn, T-H-E-L-Y-N-N-E-S-H-O-W, thelynnshow.com. Up there you can also get access to my book. And you can hear all of the interviews that I have done, all of the shows that I've done, including this one. And this one is with Rob Ruggiero, as I said, if you heard the lead-in to the show. And Rob is a delightful, passionate, articulate example of what directing for the theater can be. He is serious about what he does, and at the same time, he is self-deprecating and has a sense of humor about himself and about his work. And as I said in the lead-in, during this interview, he makes a connection between his own interests, I'm not going to tell you about it because it's much more interesting if you hear it from Rob, and this particular piece of work, the musical Showboat, which he directed for the first time for Goodspeed Opera House and is directing now again for the Oslo Repertory Theater. This is a delightful interview. And, well, I don't think I'll say any more about it because, as I said, Rob is articulate and can say it all for himself. So here is the talented, the interesting, the sensitive Rob Ruggiero. Okay, I am here with Rob Ruggiero in an office at the Oslo. And I am here with Rob because he is directing the very first show of the Oslo Repertory Theater season 2014, and that is Showboat, which he has, I know, directed before and for which he has a fondness.
Absolutely.
Okay, good.
Now, a history and a fondness.
A history and a fondness, that's right. So before we talk about the show, and I do want to talk about the show, I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And it's very clear that are you laughing?
I'm laughing because I do make my living.
And your life.
And my life.
Yes, mm-hmm. With the art of directing. Mm-hmm. And I only ask one question, and it is, can you remember, can you recall, could you tell me, what was the very first moment in your life when plays, stories, directing, moving people around, having an audience, any of that, struck you, occurred to you, happened to you?
Well, sure. I think if you go that into the root of that question, there are two defining moments, mm-hmm. I would say. One is when I did a couple of shows. I was in the chorus, like in elementary school. But, you know, I was like, you know, kind of going with the flow. The most significant route I have is when I was in high school and they needed a dancer for Oklahoma. Uh-huh. And I was Dream Curly, actually twice in my life. But that I was, you know, kind of finding my way and finding my identity. So the earlier experiences, you know, weren't as meaningful. But I'm going to back up in a minute to when I was like 8 or 9. But the really the first kind of light bulb moment, mm-hmm. I was actually a disco exhibition dancer. Not many people know that. And so that the person who was choreographing that, you know, said, they needed somebody to dance Will Parker's solo and be in the ensemble. They needed a dancer for Oklahoma. And it's interesting because I remember how life-changing that was for me. I found a place. I found my people. And if you know what that means, uh-huh. It's like I was always like a kid who related more to adults. I never found my group. I had a very, it's going to sound pathetic, but I mean this in a good way. I had a kind of sad childhood in that I didn't know where I fit. Yes. And then when I did that show, I found my family. Mm-hmm. I found my family. And all of a sudden, it turned my life around. I had this group of kids that I hung with. I found 3 people who were also in the show who were like became my BFFs. and you know, one of them has passed away, but 2 of them are still very close to me. Mm-hmm. And I found my show business family, and I found my niche. Yes. And I, you know, it's interesting, and I didn't know what part of theater, but I knew that theater was it. And, you know, I actually went to, you know, my family was like, but yeah, but you have to have a real job. And I went to college.
Oh, wait, back. You were going to talk about when you were 8 years old.
I'm going to get there.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to get there because it has to do with my first directing class.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I was a healthcare administration major at one point. And, you know, but in undergrad, I got involved in the theater department and as an actor. And I was actually, because it was a small liberal arts college, and I was doing a lot of lead roles, mm-hmm. actually. It was the actor. And, you know, and I started to kind of catalog things, and I started to begin to realize, well, I thought I was, you know, a decent actor, but I wasn't a great actor. I could sing, but I wasn't a great singer. I did a lot of fine art. I wasn't a great artist.
You could dance.
Wasn't a great dancer. So I was kind of jack of all trades, master of none. And then my senior year, another senior year moment, because Oklahoma was senior year in high school, my senior year in college, I took a directing class.
Oh, dear.
And it fit like a glove. All of a sudden, I was like, this is what I am. I'm a director because I could use all those skills and that I was kind of not amazing at and put them all together into something that I could feel I was potentially really good at. All of a sudden, I thought back when I was 8 years old, and I would get my cousins together, and I would make up skits. I never didn't remember this, and I was little. I would get them together, you know, and I would costume them, and I would make up the stories, and I would rehearse them, and then we'd show them for the rest of the family. Because I had a very big Italian family, so we'd all be together, and we'd do it, and we'd perform, and I was like, oh, my God.
You were always the director.
I was the director.
Right, you were always the director.
I didn't think about this. So those were the 2 light bulb moments. And even still after that, you know, my parents, they're still, now they're really supportive, but they, trying to protect me, were like, but you can't make a living as a director. So I have an undergraduate degree from Stonehill College outside Boston. And it was a self-directed study that was kind of a combination of theater and psychology and sociology and interpersonal communication. I had a long title. And then I, you know, I applied for grad school. I didn't get in right away because I was young. I was
in grad school in what?
Directing.
Ah.
I was too young. I was still early in the theater. So I was actually, I had a picture framing business. I framed art and in a little art studio, art gallery, and I started my own theater, my own like community theater.
Yet again.
Yeah. You know, it was like it kept going a calling, and then 6 years passed.
Wow.
6, and I applied again to grad school, and I got in, and I have a master's in directing from Rutgers University, and you know, and I had a successful business at that time. So I thought, if I don't take this chance, if I don't give theater a chance, I will live my life always wondering what if. And since then, I have a master's in directing from Rutgers in New Jersey. Since then, I have never done anything else but work in the theater. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing. It's a wonderful story.
Isn't it? Yeah. Actually, I'm 52, and when I was 49, about 2-3 years ago, my undergrad, Stonehill, gave me an honorary doctorate. I knew I was old then, so I have an honorary doctorate. But the point being, I have defined for myself a real life in the theater. And actually, when I was 39 turning 40 was the roughest year. And I was kind of struggling, I was working in the theater, but putting, utilities on credit cards and all that. I'm like, I can't do this anymore. I'm giving and giving and giving, and I'm not making it. And I decided to I explored something else for a few months. I did a production of the Laramie Project, and it told me that there was nothing else I could do. So I just decided that it was, and everything changed for me in terms of my success. And one of the things I'd love to say, which is kind of defined me, is as a young director, I did a lot of musicals. I did plays and musicals, but a lot of musicals. In my graduate work, I focused only on plays, and for a while I was the guy who did the plays. And at a certain point I've been a director now, for 30 years, but 22 years professionally. And the last decade, I think, I evolved to a place where I'm one of the few directors in the country that do plays and musicals, both. And not many directors do both.
Mm-mm.
And here I am. So.
And here you are. It's a number of things really interesting to me about this. You apparently don't remember what it was that motivated that 8-year-old. But that did not come out of nowhere. So you don't remember seeing movies or plays or having said a poem and everybody applauded or... Do you know what I mean?
No. I mean, I always like to, I said I was kind of an old soul, I will say that. I always related much better to adults than kids. I remember, silly things, like sitting in high school and, in homeroom and thinking, why are these people so immature? And so I think some people have old souls, some people have new souls.
Well, do you have siblings?
I have an older sister, 3
so you're
and a half
the baby
years.
Boy?
I'm the baby.
Yes, the baby boy in an Italian family. That must have been a very prized position.
Prized position. But I think I've always, it wasn't that I was an avid reader or anything like that, but I loved stories.
Yes.
And I think that...
Did they read to you?
Do my
parents...
Do you
know how you know that you loved stories?
No, I just by... watching TV and movies, and I liked going to the theater, but my family wasn't one that went to the theater a lot. I went with school.
Yeah. It doesn't sound like your family.
No.
No, this, you came, you're one of those...
I kind of popped
didn't,
out.
Right, who didn't...
Yeah,
didn't
like it isn't
more
like
here.
My family was in the theater or did... It was none of those kind of, I like to say, but it's not that.
No.
I just found my way. It was like a calling.
I think it's a calling. This, this is not...
Unusual.
Yeah, it's not I don't know what to say. I don't want to say that it's common, because I don't think it is common. But I don't think it's, you're a one-off, Mm-hmm. I don't think it's rare. And you describe a number of things that I've heard. The sense of finding your place. Mm-hmm. In the theater community, of being home, of finding your family, of knowing that you belong there.
It's so interesting, and I really, this is a moment I'm having right now, because the thing that defines this production of Showboat, and the thing that connected me into this particular piece of art, a piece of musical theater history, was the family, the show business family. And I never, to this moment, made the connection.
It's funny, because I heard you talk about this earlier, and I was going to say exactly
that.
Wow.
Yeah. I really haven't. It's like a little light bulb moment now, because that's the thing that moves me about Showboat, and that's the thing that inspired my whole vision for Showboat, was the show, the definition of family and show business family, because, you know, people out there who don't, who are not in theater or in, who work in show business, don't understand that we create these families quickly.
Yes.
Like, we show up at the first day of rehearsal and we're immediately intimate and immediately a family, and it lasts for, has an expiration date, and then the show's over and everybody goes their own ways, and there are certain people that you hold on to, that those relationships endure multiple productions and multiple years, sometimes
a lifetime,
multiple
a career.
Decades,
right. Mm-hmm.
And some people you're close with and have an amazing experience with, and you never see them again.
Yes, you know, forgive me, maybe this isn't accurate, but, and this just occurred to me, that good theater, good acting, maybe even good directing, demands a level of transparency, a level of vulnerability,
mm-hmm.
that inevitably leads to intimacy. And that's what makes for intimacy. And that, if you do it, if you give yourself, right, then the connections that you make based on that are really what family is.
It's so interesting that you say that, because one of my, there's like, you know, I have a handful of teachers who helped, you know, extract my artist and pull me out.
I love that. Great.
But, you know, one of them said, I remember, it was an amazing man, said, you know, a great director is as exposed as a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
And people think you can't hide, you know, and the fact, like, I don't know, like, if you're more intellectual as a person, as a person, then you're, if you're a director, your work is more intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
But my work, I mean, I love to make this joke. I don't think I'm as smart as some of the other directors, but I have a lot, I'm emotional, I have a lot of heart. I connect emotionally to a piece. And I think that's what
and
shows.
And you show that.
I think that's what shows.
You demonstrate that.
I do, and I think I have a gift of putting together family. We did, you know, doing a bunch of interviews, and I think, and I'm always, I don't know why, but I'm always surprised to hear the cast talk so emotionally, gratefully
about
me.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
And because I just do what I do, and they're like, I don't think about, like, I'm going to create a safe environment.
No, but
I'm going to create a family, because I just need to do that in order to create.
No, I think you
it's
need
really
to do that.
Wild.
I think you need to do that. I think you've needed to do that certainly since you were 8. It just took you a while to figure out how to do it in the world.
Maybe you're right.
You know.
So, you know, this production has a lot of meaning for me, because it's allowed me to articulate that story.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, really, now that I'm in this moment with you, kind of unconsciously, I mean, like, express that, my own history of that story into this piece
of art.
Into
this piece, absolutely. So, I want to talk more about you, but as long as we're at the piece.
Okay.
Do you want to talk about the piece?
Sure.
Do you want to say whatever it is that you think people would need to hear?
Well, I think that this has a lot of meaning for me. I'll give a very brief, like, overall, how it was born.
Mm-hmm.
In 2011, I was asked to direct a production of Showboat for Goodspeed Musicals.
Where you have done?
Now I've done 7 productions.
So it's a kind of home for
kind
you.
Kind of one of my artistic homes around the country.
Mm-hmm.
I have a production running there right now for The Most Happy Fella.
Uh-huh.
And they asked me to do it, and they wanted to do a Showboat. My friend and colleague there is a producer, and she's like, we want to do Showboat, but I only want to do it if you'll direct it. And I really didn't know the piece, because I thought of it as old and dusty,
mm-hmm.
my perception of it, and it's shame on me, because I really didn't know it, but I thought of it as that piece from 1927 that, you know, that opera companies do a lot and old-fashioned theaters do a lot. And
other people may have the same
perception,
right?
Misconception of it. So she continually laughs at me because it ended up being, I think, in terms of audience and sales, like the most successful production in the history of Goodspeed. But I said to her, I need to look at the material. And she's like, what? I'm like, I need to look at the material to see if I have a way to connect to it. And so I still to this day have never seen a production other than mine. But I watched the movies, the silent movie and the 36 movie. I read, at the time, the two published, the two licensable versions of the script, one being 1946 script, where they revived it and kind of defined it, because the original production was in 27, and the Hal Prince, I always want to say 94, but I think it's 92, in the early 90s Hal Prince revival, and there's the Hal Prince version, and those two, until 2 years ago, were the two that you could license. And now, there's a third.
It's the Rob version.
It's not the Rob version, although it is the Rob version.
Yes, right.
They call it the Goodspeed version, but adapted by me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a Hal Prince, so they couldn't call it the Rob Ruggiero version.
But it wouldn't have the same cachet,
but
right?
It's my adaptation,
yes, right.
And it's now available for license. And I think what appealed to them was, believe it or not, 25 is small. It has a cast of 25. The original production had a cast of about 90.
Good God.
Yeah.
Well,
90.
Nobody could afford to do it now
right.
Anyway.
And
if you had this
and the
skills,
orchestration
right?
is about 8 pieces. It sounds like about 15.
I know, because you're using synths, right?
Mm-hmm. We're using 2 synths.
Mm-hmm.
And
wait, before you go on, I feel compelled to say this, and I'm not sure if it's, well, I'm not sure what anything I say is accurate. But the fact that this thing just keeps being done suggests that it has some resonance to us, and maybe it's the resonance about family.
I mean, the showboat.
The showboat.
Yeah, showboat.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, because there are lots of musicals.
Lots of musicals, but you think about it, it was written in 1927, and that the power of the story and this particular piece of musical theater has sustained almost 100 years.
Yeah, it's remarkable.
It's remarkable. And when you look at, I do a lot of the Rodgers and Hammerstein canon, I do, I do a lot of revivals. And what you see, Oscar Hammerstein wrote the book for Showboat. Jerome Kern did the music.
Mm.
And Oscar did the book and lyrics. And it is remarkable how ahead of the time they were, how brave they were, and how this is, you know, the book does not feel old.
Wow.
But I did, you know, again, to come back to what I did, it's a streamlined showboat. It still has the entertainment values people will expect, but it's focused in on, it's a more intimate showboat, streamlined, it's shorter. Most showboats are at least 3 hours or more.
Mm-hmm.
This is with intermission, about 2.5 to 2 hours and 40 minutes. Because I made some changes here, I'm not quite sure where it's going to land, but it is edited. There are some things that are rearranged.
Tell the story about doing the second act thing.
What is most special about this showboat is the first 10 minutes of the second act are totally original. They're unique to this production. And what it is I took existing songs, existing material by the original creators, and I rearranged it to tell a story that's unique to this, and you're probably talking about my inspiration.
Okay, yeah.
So we couldn't do the World's Fair. I thought it was dusty anyway, and we couldn't literally fit it onto the stage. So I had to get from the end of Act One, which was the wedding of Magnolia and Ravenel. No spoilers there. People know the musical.
Right.
They get married at the end of the first act. And the first real big scene in the top of the second act is about 7.5, 8 years later after the wedding, the boarding house scene, I was the boarding house. So I had to get from the wedding, I had to get jump 7.5, 8 years to get to the boarding house.
And in the original, it's that's the World's Fair.
And the original, it's already just jumped. You know, the top of the second act, you just jump those years.
Right.
And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to experience the birth of the daughter, Kim, and that came from seeing the movie, the 36 movie, which I adore. I suggest people watch it. And they show, like, because she was born on the boat, and you see the family of that.
And again.
And so I thought, how am I going to do this? And what popped into my head, I do not know why, but I love it, is the movie Funny Girl. And the movie Funny Girl, there's the Sadie married lady section. If you remember, she's basically on the boat, and she gets on the boat and goes, and he gambles till he gets, he said, I won't marry you until I have the money to marry you. And he wins the big pot, and they get married. And, you know, she's Sadie married lady, and there's a little kind of montage section where you jump to her being pregnant and the painting the nursery and buying the mansion and furnishing the mansion and him and the having the baby and then the little girl being older and then him coming home, and there's a look in that movie where you see she knows he's lost everything, and she says to him, and it makes me, I'm emotional now. She says to him, I think this time you lost that ruffled shirt. And that is when bing for me. And so I've created a 10-minute montage where it starts with him gambling on the levee and her having the baby, him making money to get them off the boat, the rupturing of the family for the second time, him taking Magnolia off the boat and the baby, going to Chicago, and him losing everything.
His shirt.
Everything. And they end up in kind of ruins in the boarding house in Chicago. And I worked on it for months, and I structured it, you know, I structured a lot on my own, but I collaborated with the original music director, Michael O'Flaherty. Also, the Rodgers & Hammerstein organization opened up their archives to me, and the head of music there, Bruce Pomahack, and Ted Chapin, who's the president of Rodgers & Hammerstein, was so supportive, and we did a couple of meetings over the course of a few months, and then came the moment where they said, well, this looks great, we love it, but it has to get the approval of both estates. So go back to my performance days, myself and Michael O'Flaherty performed with a piano. Think about, I had to do most of the parts. He did most of the singing, or we sang together. We performed like a backers thing, the first 10 minutes of the second act of Showboat.
Okay, now.
And in the room.
Explain who you had to do it for and why.
In the room was Alice Hammerstein, who we're now friends, the daughter of Oscar Hammerstein, who's 92. She's, hope I say your age right, Alice, but she's, you know, but she feels she's so young. And she now has control over Oscar's estate. And then we had Julie Gilbert was there, wonderful woman, who's also a writer, actually. I didn't know, but told them that. And she is in charge of her aunt, Edna Ferber's estate.
And
Edna Ferber wrote the novel Showboat, which I recommend your listeners read. It's a fabulous, fabulous story. Fabulous story. And I've tried to incorporate some of the elements in there. And so there was Julie Gilbert and her husband. There was Alice Hammerstein, Ted Chapin, president of Rodgers & Hammerstein, Bruce Pomahack, the music director.
And
there we are. Here we are. Here's Rob Ruggiero, me, and Michael O'Flaherty. We, without stopping, performed our first 10 minutes of the second act. You know, yeah. Silence.
Oh, you're kidding.
Silence, you know, because, you know, it felt like it was a minute or two, but I'm sure it was a few seconds, but, you know, it's like breath.
Right.
And Alice, who is the more outspoken of the two, spoke first, and she said, I love it. And, you know, it's like, I'm sweaty. And to get the endorsement of Oscar's daughter, and then Julie said, oh, my God, it's wonderful. And, you know, because I'm not a conceptualist. There are directors out there who, you know, who kind of, their thing is to kind of put their own stamp onto something, and that is in the forefront. That's never in the forefront for me. I just try to solve. I figure out what I connect with, so I come up with a direction on how I want to tell a story. And then I try to solve it within the parameters of cast and set and size of theater. And, you know, I didn't try, I didn't have my idea for Showboat and fit it into the Goodspeed. I did a Showboat for Goodspeed, and the irony is the Oslo and Goodspeed are very similar spaces. And yeah. Michael Edwards came to see it there, and because part of what defines this production as well is because I didn't have enough space on stage at Goodspeed here, they have a lot of depth, but I didn't have enough space to get the show on the show. I had to get a boat on. I knew I had to get a boat. And there's a whole, you know, there are scenes, a whole rehearsal scene. So it's a beautiful 20-minute scene, like, in the middle of the first act where they're rehearsing the show.
That they're going to do on the boat.
On the boat. So, you know, I just couldn't, I couldn't put a little teeny, I just couldn't figure it out. So, ironically, the architecture of Goodspeed is almost identical to the architecture of a real showboat. It's different than the Oslo. I mean, it's almost like a full thrust, and it's like a horseshoe. Think of it as a horseshoe.
Mm-hmm.
And the stage, the little tiny stage, is at the uncurved end of the horseshoe. So I made the decision out of necessity to, because I knew, like, at the beginning, actually, when the boat arrives, I didn't have enough people to do the people at the arrival,
right.
I could just do the show people.
Right.
And you know, we have an African-American ensemble of only 7, including Queenie and Joe.
Wow.
It's Queenie and Joe. There are 2 more stevedores and 2 more gals.
Wow.
I mean, 3
That's
more stevedores
more, right.
and 2 more gals. I can't add today. And so anyway, so they're there, but the audience became the people who were there for the arrival.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And, like, there's no audience participation or anything weird like that, but they're there. And then, so I was going along, and I was like, okay, how am I going to solve the rehearsal scene? Well, the theater itself becomes the showboat. So there is Captain Andy in the middle of the audience yelling at the people on stage, and there's Joe up in the box kind of dusting the furniture, and people come in from the back of the house as if they're coming in to interrupt the rehearsal. And it ended up people had, you know, because they're not asked to participate, but they're literally in the middle of it. They're
yeah.
in the room,
right.
and then it became a wonderful tool that I use a few other places in the show. I love intimate theater.
Mm-hmm.
I run an intimate theater in Connecticut, but I also I have a huge freelance career, and I, you know, recently I took over as the producing artistic director there, but I still have an active freelance, a national profile.
Obviously.
It's exhausting.
Yes.
But I love intimate theaters. And it's, you know, funny when I think about the Oslo that the cast has been commenting on, because we're now on stage getting ready to open, is for a theater that has, like, an orchestra, a mezzanine, and a balcony.
Right.
It's remarkably intimate because there's not too many, it's all right.
It's very close. It is.
And actors love that. I love it because I don't like to feel like the performance or the life of the play is in another room. So, like, you can get that at Broadway. It's beautiful, but it's, like, way away. Here, and, like, where I love to work, I think it's what's great is that you feel
connected.
In it.
Right, you feel connected to it.
And I think that's partly the space and partly how I like to kind of create life on stage.
Mm-hmm.
And if you feel like you're in the room, you're more engaged.
Oh, there's no question
about
it. You're a part of it.
But on the flip side, and I did a talk recently here, one of the ladies was asking me if the audience, you know, it's not audience participation, which I find, like many people, uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Like you don't put an audience on the spot or ask anything of them without, you know, because they disconnect because they get all afraid.
They're scared, right.
So this is, they're welcome, they're communicated to when people are on stage. Well, people in the house are living as if they're not there. But yet, I could be next to you, you know, yelling something to someone on stage, and all of a sudden you feel like, I'm in the show.
I'm in the show.
Yeah,
right, right.
But you don't have to do anything.
No, that's right.
And there's no light on
there's
you.
There's no price to pay for it. It's just, yeah, that's right. It's vicarious, but they're right.
Yeah, it's a special showboat. You know, we all do shows, and I've been lucky to have a lot of special experiences, and this goes on the short list that people strangely respond to the show. I mean, the issue of race in showboat is very delicate. I have a wonderful, black ensemble in the show that are not afraid of this particular part of African American history, mm-hmm. yet they have a lot of integrity. Mm-hmm. And you know, one of the things also that defined the showboat is I inserted a number that was not in the original, was in the movie. I love this movie, and it's called I Still Suits Me. And so I actually gave the 10 o'clock number to Queenie and Joe.
Wow.
And when we jumped that last jump, which is about 20 years, it's like 1927, and Queenie's still in the kitchen making biscuits literally in front of you. I love that, my naturalism. Yeah. And Joe's sitting there, Whitland sitting next to her, and she's giving him a hard time, and he's letting it roll off. And Ted Chapin, president of Rodgers and Hammerstein, said, you know, well, you can do it, but it's not going to work. And, and it worked. And he said, I was wrong. And the audience, because this showboat is family-centric, and Queenie and Joe are like anchors of this show business family, the audience, and they disappear in the original production. They have all this stuff. They have, you know, Joe has Old Man River, Queenie has Misery's Coming, and they're really part of the fabric, and they kind of disappear. And so bringing them back to actually anchor
yes.
the beginning of the last chapter in the story is meaningful to everyone. And I have to say one more thing about Old Man River, which is, you know, a song that has moved people for decades and almost a century now. It's amazing to me. And you think, okay, we know it means something to a black audience, but it's amazing to me to see the effect that this song still has on any audience, young, old, black, white, Hispanic. I mean, the song has resonance that has endured decades. And you know, we did a press event on the boat here, on a boat, on, I said the river, they all laughed at me, but it was yes, intercoastal,
right.
whatever
right.
we were on.
Waterway.
It was on water. And to hear that song
on the water.
On the water is so moving. And if you, when you see the show, if you pay close attention, and I think it's the kind of show you could see actually more than once, and I don't say this just to sell tickets, because the subtle ways that I cross lines of race and class are sometimes subtle, sometimes bold, but you know, the wedding at the end of Act One is not written to be a family event, but in our production it is. This people in the levee are not there, the audience is not there, it's them getting ready to go down to the church, and that's where we're all going to see them publicly, but it's a private little celebration. And the end of this showboat is, I combine the last two scenes, and it's all about, all inspired by, and all really focused on reunion, family reunion. And that's
and this
what makes
is
it.
This is your thing.
Yeah, well, being an Italian-American, I think, you know, I grew up with very strong family values, and being a kid who didn't know my place
yeah.
in my life, or who I was, and my place in this world, and found my other family in the theater, comes full circle. This
it
show
does.
Brings it full circle
it
for
does.
Me.
It does. I mean, I really think that they couldn't have found anybody who would have understood this show quite the way you do.
Oh, thank you.
So then there's so nobody could bring that out because of your sensitivity to
thank
this
you.
Thing of family.
Well, I hope that's true.
Oh, no, I'm sure.
I hope that's true. Should we tell people a little bit of information about
how
at
they
the
can
end?
Come and all that
yeah,
stuff?
Yeah, we should do that at the end.
You could do it now and we could do it again.
You tell me.
No,
I'm
going to
throw the number in.
Please do.
Just because we're talking about it, and I think people are listening, maybe they'll be inspired. I mean, they can certainly get any information. Excuse me, everybody, for doing this, but I want you to be able to see it.
Oh, no, please. Don't apologize for that.
www.osolorep.org.
Good.
A-S-O-L-O-R-E-P.org. And the number to call for tickets is 941- 351-8000-8000. We start previews next Tuesday, November 12th. And then we open, the official opening is next Friday, November 15th. And actually they're running this show longer than any musical, I'm told. And it runs to December 29th, right through the holidays.
Lovely.
And you know, there's a scene, there's a New Year's Eve scene in the show. So if I were around here, I think...
You would want to come on New Year's Eve?
No, we don't have a show New Year's Eve. But December 29th is the last show. What a great thing to do.
So you're not going to be here?
I won't. I will be I will be in rehearsal for another play in St. Louis. We start on the 28th.
What are you doing?
I'm doing The Other Place, a play called The Other Place by Char White.
I don't know that.
An amazing play.
Not a musical.
I'm doing a project in between. And then next year I'm doing a few musicals. I'm doing at least one production of South Pacific at Paper Mill Playhouse, a very famous theater in New Jersey. I'm doing Fiddler on the Roof at Goodspeed. And I might be doing a production of Hello Dolly somewhere. So.
It's not like you're not busy.
Yes.
You don't breathe,
And a few plays thrown in.
Yeah. I was thinking that even just in terms of physical time, you don't have it. I mean, you just described a work schedule that doesn't allow for
I'm literally much. Here. We open on November 15th. They're letting me stay two nights. I asked, so I'm taking my sister's flying out actually for the opening, and I'm taking 2 days here in Sarasota because I love Sarasota, and I'm going to take a couple of days, pool, beach days, Saturday, Sunday. I fly back Monday the 18th and Tuesday the 19th. I start rehearsals for my next project.
My God. What I'm thinking is that with so many projects on the
horizon.
Right. Thank you. You have to read.
You know, I have a book on my end table
right,
now
every minute
about South Pacific
exactly,
that I've been
right.
dying to get to.
Exactly.
And it's sitting there.
I mean, it's the physical time. It's not just that you get on the stage and you say, okay, act, everybody.
You know, it's interesting, and this is going to sound like a political statement, but, you know, the difference between movies and theater, like TV commercials and movies, I mean, the compensation levels for those mediums are outrageously hot.
Right.
When you work in the theater, they're not.
No.
So we, meaning actors, directors, designers, have to put together so many projects to make a living. So you wish it was a time like where perhaps in other countries where the government subsidizes the arts more. Because I have to tell you, part of the joy of creating is that preparation time. And as you get more successful to the point where you're making a decent living because you're doing all these projects, that preparation time decreases.
It has to.
So it's like, you know, I was just talking to someone. I think I'm going to try to do it. This is my second production of South Pacific coming up, and I really love to go to Bali. You know, I would love to go there and be in that world. You know, if I was going to do a production of Evita, which is a show I'd love to do, I'd love to go to Argentina. You know, where I've been to, luckily I've already been to Napa Valley and I did The Most Happy Fella. But having been there, it has informed me, you know, we don't get that time. Or being able to read Showboat, you know, is hard to find that time.
No, it's physical time.
I did South Pacific the first time without having read Michener's book. I didn't have time.
No, I
didn't
know.
Have time. I will now, but it's...
That's the point that I was trying to make, that given, well, a couple of things. I mean, given the number of projects, the amount of time that you have to prepare decreases exponentially as you take on more projects.
Right.
And that must be a terrible challenge.
And then when you have a down day, you know, I don't really have them anymore. This is Monday.
Right.
We're recording this on Monday. It's my day off.
And you're sitting here with me.
I've had two interviews, and I have a huge press event tonight. So I'll have, like, and I spent the hours that I'm not doing what I'm doing here, checking with my theater in Connecticut. So I'll maybe have a couple of hours to myself. Do I want to spend that
reading the
you know, I want to I want to nap by the pool.
Right, I was just
going
to say, right.
And I have a design meeting today on the phone. It's really challenging, very, very challenging.
It is, and I want to...
We work hard as artists.
You do.
But people don't realize when they go and they see the fun, they have fun and they laugh and it looks beautiful, you know, that in a particular scene or a particular moment of a play, we might spend upwards of 45 minutes to an hour making it work so it seems effortless.
Yes.
You know, the way that, you know, someone makes a quick costume change while a set piece is moving and lights are changing and the piece of music that's happening. And so it all flows and you're like, oh, that, you didn't even know it happened.
That's right.
But you notice when it doesn't work, you know, when somebody's skirt falls down on stage or somebody's, you know, wig pops off. You notice
misses
an entrance.
Right.
You notice those.
That's right.
But when it's all working, you just think this is good. But I'm a real truth seeker. I believe, even though most audiences, if it's a great show, might not know the difference that it's the right glass or the right eyeglasses or the right phone, but they'll have a good time. But when that specificity is there on stage, They don't know it's because it's the right costume and the right lamp and the right phone and the right eyeglasses, but they feel this.
No, it's an unconscious,
truthful. So
right.
I think I'm a good audience, and to me, what I think is a great production, because I can easily get into looking at the lights and looking at this, but I have an innocence that I'm able to kind of bring when I walk in the door, and there are still pieces that take me away. Mm-hmm. That I forget I'm in the theater, and I forget that there's light cues and costumes and all that, and I engage with the story, and when that happens, I know it's special.
Yeah, yeah.
And I hope that this showboat will bring that kind of experience to the Oslo audiences.
Well, I want to say that it's clear that your commitment is to bringing that kind of experience to every audience that you present a piece to.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
And I hope that it will inspire your listeners to come and see Showboat.
How could they not come knowing that you directed it? Okay, so I ask one other question.
Sure.
And it is, having given as much of your life as you have...
Oh, back to me. You like talking about me.
I do. I like talking about you. To this work, to the theater, is there anything you would say about what that's like?
Yes. It's challenging. It's interesting that... I mean, I'll say two things. One is I've tried hard, very hard, to keep having a life outside the theater, and it's very hard. And one of my mentors said, you have to have a life, otherwise you have no life to bring to the work.
Uh-huh.
And you know, but still it's a challenge to keep up with friendships and relationship, and I've had a number of relationships, but I'm single now. But it's like a vocation. It's like being
a doctor.
It's like being a doctor,
right.
Or a priest,
yes.
or any of those things where, you know, my life is defined a lot by my work. And you know what? I'm okay with that. I feel very blessed. I'm lucky, and I really try to make sure that I have great life experiences. I don't get to go on as many vacations as most people. I don't have that. I've done it 5 o'clock, and I have my weekends. But... Oscar Wilde said, I hope I quote this right, Oscar Wilde quote, to live is the greatest thing in the world. Most people exist.
Yes.
That is all. But I feel like there's a price on one side, but my life has been lived.
Yes.
And I don't have any regrets for that. And there's a price for that. You know, there's a price for that. But I wouldn't trade my life. If I could go back, I'd make the same choices.
I want to thank you very much for this.
It's been a pleasure to be here.
All right, so we'll see you all at the theater.
We'll see you at the theater.
Thanks, Rob.
I neglected to say at the beginning of this show that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, because when you listen to them, you can hear what it sounds like to be who you really are. Because people who make their living or their life with an art do it because they can't help it. It is who they really are. And as you heard in Rob, it doesn't matter that he forgot that experience when he was 8 years old that might have told him that he was a born director. But when he had an experience later in life, he knew it. He knew this was who he was. He was home. He was with his people. He was with his family. And you hear at the end where he's saying that never mind that it's difficult. Never mind that you have to put together so much work that you don't get a chance to rest. Never mind that it makes relationships very difficult. He doesn't regret it, and he wouldn't do anything else because this is who he is. And so, as always, when I interview someone like Rob, I want to say thank you for demonstrating this so clearly, and to say to you all that it is my hope that as you listen to Rob, you are perhaps inspired to ask yourself, did you have an experience in your early childhood, something that really engaged you, really captured you, which you then forgot, moved away from, denied? Is there something waiting inside of you that would feel like home, that would be so powerful for you that you would be willing to endure discomfort in order to be it? Is there a piece of yourself which you've been cheated out of? If that is so, if you even have the suspicion that that is so, I hope you'll pursue it, if only just to wonder, if only just to be curious. And if you want to do more than wonder, more than be curious, I currently do all of my psychotherapy on the phone these days, and you can reach me at my website, where you can find all this other stuff, thelynnshow.com. You can click on email me. You can read the article I wrote about psychotherapy on the phone, called Psychotherapy on the Go. And you can get me to come and speak to your group or organization. Well, as always, I hope that you heard something in this show that you can use, something that inspired you, something that made you laugh, something that triggered something important for you, even just something that you didn't know that you know now, something that will bring you back, because I will be back next week. Same time, same station. And as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight, no. I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated. Oh, without a fight, no. I will not go gentle into that good night.